I went to South Africa as one of a small group of 10 individuals, men, all Jews, who were invited by the South Africa Foundation in conjunction with the South African Jewish Board of Deputies. The South African Board of Deputies is the equivalent of our Council of Jewish Federations and Welfare Funds. The South Africa Foundation was established a number of years ago by the leading industrialists and business people of South Africa who got religion when they discovered that you can't do business if the rest of the world won't do business with you. And as a result, the South Africa Foundation has taken a leading role in recent years in pressing for any number of reforms, for political negotiations. It was the chairman of this foundation, who incidentally is the chief executive officer of the leading South African business, the Anglo-American Corporation, that the Anglo-South African Corporation, rather, and the executive director of that body, who some months ago went up to Lukasa to meet with the leadership of the exiled and banned African National Congress, which the world has more or less recognized as the exiled political group which is most responsible for the liberation of the non-white population in South Africa. As far as I know, there was no litmus political test for membership in this group. The group was diverse. It ranged from Martin Peretz, the editor of the New Republic, to Rabbi Israel Miller, the senior vice president of Yeshiva University, who's also a former president of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, to Dr. Nathan Glazer, who is the professor of sociology and education at Harvard and one of our leading experts on intergroup relationships, to myself. And nothing was asked of us. I'm mindful of the story which James Fairbanks, the well-known Harvard sinologist, often tells. He said that anyone who came to China for 6 weeks wrote a book, anyone who came to China for 6 months wrote an article, and anyone who stayed in China for 6 years wrote nothing. So this week and next week's talk on the Jewish situation in South Africa will really be the extent of my comments, or a sense of a private report to you, my congregation, rather than a public statement of some position or other on the issues, which the very complicated issues which are raised by the troubles of that country. In our visit, we spent 10 full days in the Republic of South Africa. We spent the major part of our time in Johannesburg, Durban, and Cape Town, although we also took a small plane trip into Natal to the capital of what's called KwaZulu, which is the Zulu homeland where a man by the name of Chief Buthelezi has established a very interesting government homeland, which takes position strongly against those of the government in many issues, but also believes that there are ways in which, through power sharing, blacks and others can cooperate in creating at least in Natal, a new kind of power sharing, a new kind of state. For most of our trip, I felt that I was in South Africa, meeting South Africans, but not quite situated in the geography of the place. We were at meetings morning, noon, and night, from 7 o'clock to midnight, and it wasn't until the very last day that they gave us a kind of decompression day. We were in Cape Town, and for once we became tourists, and we went down along the very beautiful coast south of Cape Town, which runs down to what they call Cape Point, which is the headlands where the waters of the Atlantic and the Indian Oceans meet. And one had a sense for the first time, really, of the spaciousness and the beauty of this part of the world. Most of our time was spent in meetings. There were meetings, and there were meetings, and there were more meetings. We met with a number of the faculty from Cape Town University, a very liberal faculty, many of whose Those who met with us were active supporters of the African National Congress, or the United Democratic Front, which is the local umbrella organization of groups working for black non-white rights and for liberation. We met again at another day with a group of faculty from Stellenbosch University, which is the Afrikaner University near Cape Town, a much more conservative group, as you might imagine, some of whom actually believed that the African National Congress was nothing more than a communist front organization. We met with a man by the name of Seth Cooper, who is the head of an organization called AZAPO, which is the Black Consciousness Organization, whose motto is Africa for the Africans, and by that they mean the black Africans. They want a black African state in all of South Africa. We met with a man named Andreas Treurnicht, a divine of the Dutch Reformed Church, who is the leader of something called the Conservative Party, which is the growing party which has broken away from the ruling Nationalist Party on the grounds that the very modest reforms which the Nationalist Party has introduced in the last several years are heresy against the traditions of South Africa. We met with members of Parliament from the National Party, from the Progressive Party. We met with that doughty old elderly lady, Helen Sussman, who has been a lone spokesman very often in Parliament. She's been a member of Parliament for the last 33 years for reform, who has spoken up with great personal courage about the abominable acts that the security forces and others have performed in the name of apartheid. We met with trade leading people, we met with educators, we met with people who are working to bring clinics and medical help, to people who are working to bring better housing to the poor, the underprivileged, those who suffer the indignities of that country. And so I left having heard many, many people talk about the problems of South Africa. Certainly I left convinced that the problems were not black and white, as they often seem to be when you read only the headlines of the local papers. There were all kinds of shades of gray and all kinds of predictions about what could, would, and should happen in that part of the world. And as I began to think how I should make this report to you this morning, I thought perhaps the best way to begin was to report to you a complaint which I first heard on my flight down to Johannesburg, which I heard repeated a number of times by whites in South Africa. The man in the next seat on the plane was a South African businessman who had been in the United States for some reason or other. He was English-speaking, that is, he was not an Afrikaner. He told me he had voted for the Progressive Party, the party of moderate reform. And his complaint ran something along these lines. Why has South Africa become the whipping boy of the world? He can think of many worse countries. I'd much rather live, even as a black in South Africa, than I would rather live in, say, the USSR, or Albania, or Cambodia, or Syria, or Iran. And if I look about Africa itself, even admitting that there is a degree of callous use of the police power in South Africa, there's a much greater degree of arbitrariness and tyranny in countries like Zaire and Ethiopia and Uganda. Why is South Africa then the country, and he used the colloquialism, which the world dumps on? Why is South Africa the whipping boy of the world? On my way down, I listened. After all, I was going to South Africa to learn. On my way back, fortunately, there was no one in the next seat, and I had a chance to try and put together my own feelings about all that I'd heard and seen and all that we talked about. And I decided that although I had no logical answer for his complaint, I couldn't answer it directly. I had very little sympathy for it. When I asked myself whether I would rather live in one of those abjectly poor reservations in South Africa, which the South African government glorifies with the title of tribal homelands, or would rather live in a gulag in Siberia, I had to admit that I would probably rather be an impoverished black in one of these homelands. Why? Because at least then there'd be some hope for the future, if not mine, for my children's. And if I reminded myself of what we'd done the last day in South Africa, I had to admit that there's a degree of freedom of expression in South Africa, which one doesn't find in many other parts of the world. The press of South Africa, at least the English language press that I could read, was remarkably free with a high degree of criticism of actions of the South African government. Our last night in Cape Town, we'd gone to theater. It was the major repertory theater of Cape Town. And we went to see a play which was called Made in the RSA, Made in the Republic of South Africa. It's a poor play, but it's a no-holds-barred, knock-down attack on the South African government. It pulls no punches about the abuses of the security forces, about the ignorance of the whites in their, towards black and non-white groups and their feelings, about the nobility with which and patience with which the blacks have accepted the abominable acts which the whites have shown towards them. And I doubt that there is another, I'm sure there's no other capital in Africa or in Eastern Europe in which a government would tolerate that such a play as part of the above ground, this is an underground play, above ground repertory theater in what is equivalent to a national theater. I also had to admit that there was a degree of truth to the complaint that was often voiced to us that so much of the moral outrage that is apparent here in the United States and Europe towards South Africa is not only highly selective, but exists for domestic purposes. That is, it has been used in the last 2 or 3 years by the flagging organizations in the civil rights movement in order to encourage greater energies for issues which are domestic rather than having to do directly with the concerns of South Africa. But having said all of that, what you see in South Africa is a country where 72% of the population, the black population, have no say whatsoever in their destiny, where 12% of the population, the so-called white population, controls the majority, almost all of the power and the majority of the wealth of the country. You're in a country where again and again you come across statistics, realities which are sickening. The rate of infant mortality among whites in South Africa is relatively equivalent to ours. It's about 17 per thousand. Infant mortality, the rate of infant mortality among blacks is estimated. There are no real figures kept among blacks, and that's itself an indication of the kind of country it is. But the estimates are that the rate of infant mortality among blacks is something over 200 per thousand. In South Africa, you go to school by your classification. That is, the government schools, there are black schools, there are Asian schools, there are colored schools, there are white schools. 1% of those who are black in each age cohort matriculates from high school. The numbers who matriculate from high school are in South Africa who are white are much higher than ours. They're close to 90%. The South African government in 1985 spent $660 per white student in their education. And the white government of South Africa spent $94 per student for each black student in its school system. What you find in South Africa is that there are many different levels of services, and where you're talking about urban services, the normal services, which are health and welfare services, the blacks, the non-whites, are always way down there at the bottom of the barrel. South Africa depends upon racism, and I use the word advisedly. The basic law in South Africa which governs all else is the Population Registration Act, which was originally invoked in 1950, though segregation has a long history in South Africa, and has been, until the last several years, was ever more rigidly enforced. Now, Jews particularly have reason to know that this whole theory of race is a highly questionable one. But in South Africa, it determines your destiny. How you are classified determines where you can live, your children will go to school, what kind of jobs you can have, whether or not you'll be allowed to enter a certain area, live in a certain area, whether if your house is expropriated, you'll be forced to go to live in a certain tribal area. Everything depends upon how your passbook is stamped. And the classifications are complex. Anybody who is white, provided they can prove that they are white. And then you have non-white, which includes Asian, Chinese, colored, Cape Malay, the Malaysians, the descendants of Malaysians who came to the Cape 100 years ago to work in the farms. Several days after we arrived, I found this article in this little article in one of the papers, which shows you the degree to which this kind of population classification has been refined. It's entitled 1167 Race Changes Recorded. A total of 1167 people were reclassified from one race group to another in 1985. The Minister of Home Affairs, Mr. Stoffel Botha, said yesterday in reply to a written question in Parliament. The largest number of reclassifications were of 702 people from colored to white. A total of 249 blacks reclassified as Cape colored. Other reclassifications were white to colored 19, Indian to white 1, Chinese to white 3, Indian to colored 50, colored to Indian 43, Indian to Malay 21, Malay to Indian 30, Cape colored to black 20, black to other Asian 2, black to Griqua 1, colored to Chinese 11, colored to Malay 3, Chinese to Cape colored 1, Malay to Cape colored 8, and black to Malay 3. What you have, in other words, is a complicated state apparatus, which knows you not as a name and not as an individual, but as a member of a racial, in quotation marks, classification. And there's nothing more saddening or sickening to read than the story which appears occasionally in the papers of how South Africa deals with the ultimate problem which its bureaucracy must face, a foundling found on the door of some hospital of unknown parentage. How do you classify this infant? You're ultimately there facing the question of what is a race? And there are all kinds of learned papers which are published in South Africa. If you take a comb and put it through the child's hair, if the hair is curly, it's non-white, it's colored. If the hair is, the comb will slip through, then it's white. I mean, it's a mishmashugasis, it's that. What you have in South Africa is then a racist state, a state in which you and I would be white, presumably. It matters not what our background would be, or our culture would be, or our quality, our class. The ultimate identification is that of racial qualification. And if we're fortunate enough in the present state to be white, then all doors, all opportunities are open to us. And if we are unfortunate enough to be one of these lesser breeds without the law, then depending upon the part of the country where we live and depending upon the particular configuration of that world, we will live in a particular area which may have more amenities or less amenities. We will be allowed to go from one area to another, but not to a third, and that will be determined entirely by our classification. All kinds of rules and regulations will apply to us simply for this arbitrary reason. And following on this Population Registration Act comes the other basic act which governs apartheid, and that's the Group Areas Act. The Group Areas Act is simply this. It says that depending upon your classification, if you're an urban area, there are only certain parts of that urban area in which you may live, and if you are in the rural areas, you may not come to the urban areas except with very, very special and hard to get papers and permissions. And if the government should uproot you from one area, they have the power to arbitrarily assign you to an area which has been arbitrarily assigned to your tribal or racial group. And so what you find when you visit South Africa is that the major downtown areas seem very much like our own, that there are gorgeous white suburban areas whose configurations are magnificent, with the foliage, the homes rival anything that you can find any place in the United States. Where there are modest areas in which some of the more fortunate subgroups live, and even some of the more fortunate black groups live, and there are vast tracts of land which are simply areas into which blacks particularly have been funneled and are more or less housed in the most miserable of conditions. The first day we were in South Africa, we were taken to Soweto. Soweto is that famous non-white counter city to Johannesburg, which has been built about 12 miles from the downtown area behind the pilings of the rand, of the leavings from the great deep gold mines which were in operation years ago near Johannesburg. Soweto is today a town or a series of towns of well over 1 million people. When you visit Soweto, you're struck at first by the fact that it doesn't look so bad. There are many areas of Soweto which, though the homes are quite modest and there's very little land, you see neat, well-kept three, four-family homes, often in brick, with some kind of planting in front of them. And it looks to be far better than anything one would call a slum, even in the United States. There are, of course, some very bad areas, some slum areas in Soweto. But one is moved to think that, well, this is the South African argument, people of ethnic groups like to live together, and it really isn't so bad here. There are schools, there are clinics, there are soccer fields, there are some of the amenities. But if you look with an eye not to just what you're seeing, but what the reality of Soweto is, you recognize the indignity of those who live there. The first indignity is that they have to live there. It's not the fact that some suburbs of Cleveland have no blacks in them. By law, blacks could live in Bay Village. But the truth here is that blacks can only live in Soweto or in Alexandra or in a number of designated townships around Johannesburg. They have no choice. Moreover, they can't own the land which is under their homes. All of these little houses are on land which is rented from, on leasehold, from the South African government. Because the South African government has decreed that blacks ultimately are not to live in the sacred land of the Union of South Africa. And the original plan was to use this labor as long as it's needed near Johannesburg and then ultimately get black labor back to the tribal homelands where they can develop, quote, their own indigenous culture and way of life under their own leadership. And so what you find is that there is no real ownership. You're living there on sufferance, although in recent months the government has said that they will begin to increase the leasehold to 99 years and ultimately make it possible for them to own land. That the school systems where these children go are radically inferior to the school systems in the white areas of Johannesburg. That the clinics are not the equivalent of the clinics in the white areas. That the police can come and break down your door and enter to investigate who lives in a home anytime that they want. You don't need a search warrant in South Africa to enter a home. And there are periodic police investigations to make sure that no one who doesn't have the right papers is living in a home. And one of the great human tragedies of South Africa is that there is more work in the cities than in the countryside, therefore that traditional movement of people from the rural areas to the urban areas, but that the police want to keep them back from the urban areas, and so they periodically make sweeps through areas of Soweto to make sure that uncles, aunts, husbands, and wives who may be in these homes and do not belong there, do not have the right under their laws to be there, will be deported back to their homelands. There was an article when while you were there that there was something on the order of 150,000 deportations from the Johannesburg area back to the tribal homelands in 1985. What you're dealing with there, therefore, is a situation which is been organized for, imposed upon, endured by. And one of the things that I noticed, and which no one commented on, is that as you drive through Soweto, despite the fact that many of these houses look fairly adequate, you're hard-pressed to find a store. And they're only, for the city of over a million people, I discovered there are only two very small shopping centers. Because the white merchants of Johannesburg have made sure that when blacks go to buy, even when they go to buy food, they'll leave the black areas and the black storekeepers and go into the white areas and to the profit of the white storekeepers in those areas. Moreover, Soweto is one of the closer in working areas for those who work in Johannesburg. It costs about 8 to 10% of a black worker's wages to take the bus, or what they call a combi, a minibus, into work each day and to return. It's only about 45 minutes or an hour. But there are other black settlement areas around the Johannesburg and other major towns where it may take you as much as 2 to 3 hours a morning and 2 to 3 hours a night and as much as 20% of your, believe me, modest salary in order to be able just to get to work and to get back. If we were to think of Cleveland in terms as Johannesburg or Cape Town in terms of Cleveland, you would find that the white suburbs are all the close in. And then the Indian colored suburbs, the next ring of suburbs. And then way beyond the outer belt, there are the black suburbs, the black townships. In Cape Town, there's a squatters area which is called Crossroads. It's often reported in the papers because it's there that much of the violence which makes the papers occurs. Crossroads is a squatters village, so it has about 200,000 people. It has, they estimate, about 80,000 children of school age, one school which takes 1,000 students and has 5 teachers. The government has deliberately tried to prevent Crossroads from becoming a permanent settlement. The people refuse to move to the settlement which is being prepared for them because the settlement which the government would like them to move into is 15 miles further out from Cape Town than Crossroads, which is already 15 miles out from the city itself. Because they know the time and the cost which will be involved if they move out there just to come to the city for the whatever jobs they can find in Cape Town. And so between the Population Registration Act and the Group Areas Act, apartheid in all of its social manifestations, most of its political manifestations, is healthy and well in South Africa. A single story epitomized for me what I saw. It's a story of a 27-year-old Cape Malay woman. She had the misfortune of being in an automobile accident near Pretoria. Pretoria is the capital of South Africa in the Transvaal. It's an Afrikaner center. She suffered major injury to her spinal column. She was taken to the major hospital in Pretoria. She was put into the intensive care unit for Muslims in that hospital. Now, that intensive care unit is equipped to deal with certain kinds of injuries and illnesses, but not with major spinal cord illnesses, injuries. In another wing of the same hospital, there is one of the finest centers for the study and treatment of spinal cord injuries in all of the world. The accident took place on the 7th of December. The pleas, petitions, a family of lawyers had not been able to get the hospital authorities to move her bed, this patient, what, 100 yards from the Muslim intensive care unit where she'd been put to the unit where she could get the kind of care which would be first-class care of the highest world class. And the papers in late March finally told this story. When I mentioned it that night to one of the local doctors with whom I was talking, he said to me, you know, she was unfortunate doubly in that if the accident had taken place near Cape Town, she would have been taken to the major Cape Town hospital, and there's also a fine major spinal cord injury unit, and she would have been taken immediately into that unit because that hospital is fully desegregated. And he used this as an example to me of the kind of crazy quilt pattern which you find now in South Africa. In the last 2 or 3 years, under economic and pressures, under world pressures, there has been a relaxation by the government of a number of the rules and regulations or practices of apartheid. Hospitals have been allowed to desegregate their wards, provided the staff of the hospitals were willing to do so. As when I walked around Johannesburg, I could still see the paint, which was put on a few months ago over restrooms, which said, you know, either white or non-white. This had all been blacked out. Now anyone could go in. All of the major hotels and most of the major restaurants in the great urban areas have been desegregated. And they're honestly so. In our hotels, you saw blacks as guests of the hotel, in the restaurants of the hotel, often being served by whites. There is, in a sense, between 9 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the major centers, a feeling of being in a desegregated environment. In Cape Town, the beaches of the municipality have all been desegregated, but the beaches of some of the suburbs have not yet been desegregated. The local councils have not yet, are unwilling to vote for it. On the trains, there are now first-class coaches which are desegregated, but there are also still first-class coaches for whites only. It's a strange pattern of a country which recognizes, or seems, the government seems to recognize the direction it must go, but always is pulling back from going fully in that direction. And of course, the blacks and the non-whites and liberals generally call these changes cosmetic, and they're right, they are. And the whites, especially the most obstinate and obdurate of them, look upon them as scandalous, as a sign of weakness. And the National Party, which is the party which in the 50s and 60s took segregation and transferred it into apartheid, into a scientific separation of the community, the Nationalist Party is now facing a major revolution on its right from the conservative parties, and there is even a party more rightist than that, who are growing in strength, particularly in the Afrikaans community, and who are insisting that apartheid and all of its rigor must, in fact, be maintained. But to give in is to show weakness, and once they show weakness, that's the beginning of end for South Africa as they know it. And the South African government, the government of Premier Botha, seems at the moment at least to know part of what needs to be done. They've spoken of rescinding the pass laws, which to a very large degree limit freedom of movement for non-whites. But they've also said that they're going to impose some new movement restrictions on movement so that the urban areas will not be inundated. The government of Botha seems to know many of the things that ought to be done, but it's more worried about the rebellion on its right than it is about the 80% of the population which are to the left. And that's tragic, because the window of opportunity for evolutionary change in South Africa in terms of time is very limited. The blacks, facing this inconsistent pattern of reform, quite rightly dismiss it as a band-aid, as cosmetics for the purpose of placating the world. But they have another kind of problem. The first day we were in South Africa, we had a little breakfast for us, which was an orientation breakfast, and we happened to meet Bayard Rustin in the hotel, so we invited him to join with us. He's working now for the National Endowment for Democracy, and one of his areas is that of South Africa. And we spoke with Mr. Rustin out of his long experience with American civil rights movements about what he's seen. He's been there 4 or 5 times in the last year. And he said to us, what you'll see is a country where there's a great deal of sloganeering and not much real politics. That is, on the right, the government is not yet ready, prepared, or feels strong enough to really sit down and negotiate what is the ultimate question in South Africa, the redistribution of power. And on the left, that is, in the liberal and then the non-white community, you have no agreement as to what needs to be done, and you have very little in terms of real leadership. And that is the fault, of course, of the actions of the South African government themselves over the last 30 years, who have imprisoned or exiled or banned or deported the major leaders, the natural leaders of the black community particularly, but also of the Indian community and the colored community as well. The imprisonment of Nelson Mandela is, in a sense, the symbol of this kind of this comment. And what you have, therefore, in the black areas is sloganeering, which he defined as a desperate attempt of the middle age to keep up with their young. Which is to say that in the absence of the ability of the middle age, those who have authority traditionally in any community, to produce real, tangible political results, and in the face of black unemployment of the young, which in areas around Cape Town, and particularly around Port Elizabeth and Durban and Johannesburg, may run from 25% to 60%. The youth are free, they are semi-educated, most of them have not graduated from high school, few of them have had more than 3 or 4 or 5 years of the most elementary and rudimentary kinds of education, and they are in the streets showing their muscle. They are full of slogans, he said, but they have no positive program. And so what we saw in South Africa among the non-white community, particularly the black community, was a great debate. And the debate centered really around a fascinating issue. The issue was, should black students go to school next year? This is now about the beginning of the school year. And one of the slogans of the young is liberation before education, which is part of a program which is more or less developed, which says, we're going to bring the natural operations of South Africa to a close. We're going to boycott the white stores. We're going to strike the white businesses. We're not going to go to these inadequate schools. We'll bring the economy to a standstill, and then we'll have the revolution, the exchange of power, which we all fervently pray for. And what you're seeing in South Africa was largely being reported here, and being reported, I must say, in South Africa, is a series of attacks by blacks on blacks, particularly by black youths on black, what they call Uncle Toms. Attempts to get all of those who claim leadership, most of those have gotten the middle age have gotten their leadership because they've been given this power by one white authority or another, and to replace them with people who are more acceptable to the young. Now, there's very little difference between what the young are doing in these countries, in these communities, and pure criminal activity. These are young black gangs who are have both a criminal agenda, many of them, and a political agenda, or half-formed political agenda. And Rustin said that morning something which I found to be true. He said, the whites are running to try and keep up with their black young. We think of black leadership in South Africa in terms of Bishop Tutu, in terms of Alan Bosack, the colored minister who was so important in the Cape Town area, who is the chairman of the Council of Churches of South Africa. Rustin says that these men are now, in a sense, prisoners of the young. They have no real political base in the communities. And therefore, they are in the position now of having to say to groups around the world which want to help with the building of clinics or the building of schools or the amelioration of the condition, don't come, don't send money, don't send your young, we don't want the help. And they do this because they accuse those who would come and help as simply ameliorating the condition, band-aiding the condition, propping up a government which they say must ultimately fall. And they want that fall to be sooner rather than later. In other words, the attempt is to bring South Africa to a standstill. Now, the problem is that if the revolution were really 6 months off, this kind of approach might, in fact, be effective. But there is no one we talk to in South Africa of scholarly competence who believes that the revolution is 6 months off or even a year or 2 or 3 years off. What we heard again and again from the political officers of our consulate there, what we heard again and again from those who are historians and scholars in South African politics and history, is that the security forces of South Africa have not yet begun to be tested. They have not yet begun to show the full range of their power. And don't assume, as I think some of people have done from the comments I've heard since I'm back, that you can't walk securely in downtown Johannesburg or Cape Town and do your shopping or do all the normal things that occur in the course of a day without any realization that there's trouble in the country. You can. What you have in South Africa, which is a vast country, two-thirds the size of the United States, is an occasional act of violence, occasional mass demonstration, but that those who demonstrate are to a very large degree unarmed. I didn't say disarmed, but unarmed. They've never had the arms. And their ability to disrupt the society is to a very large degree exaggerated by them and by their leaders. I believe that unless there is major structural political reform in South Africa in the next few years, there will be a violent revolution in that part of the world. But I would also believe that that revolution will not come in the short term, in the immediate future. There is slowly emerging in South Africa a new, more responsible, responsive to its own needs, black leadership. But it's a long way from having any real power. And the African National Congress, which has been in being for over 50 years, is one of the world's most unsuccessful liberation movements. I asked one of the political officers at our embassy in Cape Town what he estimated the manpower strength of the African National Congress outside of South Africa to be. And he said the government estimates it to be about 3,000. There are masses who can be turned out into the streets in South Africa, into the streets of the black townships. But there are, believe me, there is a well-armed, well-equipped, well-trained army which is prepared to go into the field against them. And probably as well as any country in the world, the South African army has learned how to seal its borders against the importation of terrorist armament and equipment. What can be done? What should be done? In the United States, you hear a great deal about divestment and disinvestment. Divestment in South African terms means the selling by universities or other groups of stock of companies that do business in South Africa or with South Africa. Disinvestment they use as the term which describes the actual sale by these companies or the abandonment by these companies of the businesses which they are running in South Africa. Sanctions, of course, are the imposition of embargoes upon one or another area of contact, economic, business contact with South Africa. When you look at each of these, there are problems. Divestment means simply that you sell the stock that is in General Motors, because General Motors has and Ford have plants in South Africa, and somebody's going to buy that stock. And about 90% of the production of both of these companies is bought by blacks in South Africa and used for the transportation of blacks who would otherwise not be able to move from where they live to where they can do business. They're mostly these minibuses, what they call combis. And of course, if businesses pull out of South Africa, the people who are going to be most hurt are the workers who have nothing to fall back on. There's no safety net, there's no welfare in South Africa. If a person strikes, and there's the right to strike in South Africa, the employer also has the right to dismiss him arbitrarily and to replace him with another worker, and there's no unemployment compensation, unemployment insurance that the worker can turn to. So the question is really a hard one. I would never argue with anyone who is arguing for divestment, but I'm also not convinced that divestment in human terms is worth the cost. Disinvestment has some of the same problems. If an American company sells or even abandons its machinery in South Africa, someone else will come in. And one of the interesting realities of the economics as they were explained to us is that as American companies have disinvested, their machinery has been bought up by Japanese, Singapore citizens, Malaysians, and others who have taken this machinery from Johannesburg and Cape Town and Port Elizabeth out to the boondocks. where they've reestablished it in the so-called homelands, where they can employ workers, because there's no work in these homelands, for the equivalent of 20 rands a month. You know what 20 rands a month is? $10. And the trade union people with whom we met, who have long histories of dealing with a very difficult government, which are those who are most adamant about the dangers implicit in disinvestment, because there's always somebody who's willing to do the business. What about sanctions? For a long time now, the Europeans and the Americans have sanctioned the sale of arms to South Africa. Result? South Africa has today one of the most modern arms-producing capacities in the world. The result? In 1985, the Republic of South Africa sold $1.25 billion worth of arms to Iraq. The result? In 1985, we heard that the Republic of South Africa sold $500 million worth of dollars worth of arms to Iran. If you ever wonder how South Africa gets its oil, the answer is very simple. They sell arms for oil. We put an oil, we would assume that there was an oil embargo on South Africa. The result? The South Africans have developed the most advanced plants for the transference of their large coal supply into gas and oil. And they've found that they can buy oil, in any case, in many ways, on the so-called spot market. America is not, despite what you hear, the major supplier of trade, the major trade partner of South Africa. England is. America is not the major investor in South Africa. England is. Europe is second. England and the United States is only third. What the business people of South Africa seem to fear most would be the absence of investment monies. And they were much relieved a few weeks ago when the European banks picked up after the Americans, after President Reagan said no more lending to South Africa from our major banks, and were willing to continue lending monies to various businesses in South Africa. And when we talk to those who are the students of the finances of South Africa, the economists, they tell us, you know, there's always someone, someplace in the world who at the right rate of interest is willing to lend you money. So it's very hard to be able to work out exactly how one can bring the kinds of pressure on South Africa which are necessary, if or which we think to be necessary. And I left South Africa really feeling that the South African problem is a South African problem. They're going to have to face the issues themselves, deal with them in their own terms, and come to their own solutions and pay whatever price must be paid for past sins and present compromises or present solutions.